Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we're going to listen to an interview that I did last week with Thunder Levin. He's a producer, he's a director, he's a writer, he's done all kinds of interesting things. It is a recording, so please don't call in. Hi, Thunder. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited. I can't wait to chat with you. Do you want to start by just explaining how you came about to get into the business? Or would you like to talk about movies or your inspiration? We can start anywhere.
Well, it's your interview. I'll go wherever you lead.
Well, let's start with what movies did you like when you were growing up as a kid?
Oh, well, I mean, before I even got to movies, when I was little, my favorite TV show was the original Star Trek. And I think that had a big influence on my life. I didn't really go to a lot of movies as a little kid. I didn't even get to see Jaws when it came out in the theater because my parents were afraid it would give me nightmares. So I guess I love 2001, which is probably odd for a little kid. I remember Silent Running, which was sort of this science fiction movie with a real environmentalist bent to it. And then, of course, the movie that really affected me, I think, and got me started thinking about movies as a career was Star Wars.
Interesting. Silent Running was such an... When the first time I saw that was in a college class, a film class in college, and it was so interesting because it was so different from the movies that were big at the time, which was like Star Wars and stuff like that. It's quiet. It's really basically survival, and it's quiet. What interested you in it when you were so young?
Well, you're right. It was very quiet and pretty slow. And I think probably what interested me about it was just it was science fiction and it was cute little robots. And remember, that was actually several years before Star Wars came out. And there weren't a lot of movies like that, real high quality, high production value science fiction films. I mean, there'd been 2001, but the studios weren't really making high-end science fiction. I think Silent Running was, 1972 or 73? The whole blockbuster era hadn't started yet. And so it was just a rare opportunity to see a movie on a spaceship and with fun robots and stuff. And I think as a kid, that's what I zoomed in on. And I don't know if the whole environmentalist message really was a part of my appreciation of it back then. But I spent a lot of time in the country, in the woods. My dad was sort of, I wouldn't say he was a hippie, but he was into being in the woods and camping and stuff. So I had a certain appreciation for that despite living in New York City. And so I think it just made sense to me, and I couldn't understand why anybody would want to destroy the last forest. I got the whole environmental thing without really thinking about it.
It was ahead of its time.
Oh, definitely. It was a generation ahead of its time. But I mean, if that movie came out today, you know, it would be a whole environmental movement rallying cry kind of thing. Whereas back then it was just a movie.
Also, I think one of the reasons it was so good, this is my opinion, is that it was Bruce Dern. Was such a good actor, you believed him whatever he did.
yeah, absolutely. And it was, it felt very real. Or at least it did then. I haven't watched it in years. Sometimes you go back and watch these things and they're not nearly as good as you remember them. But yeah.
Yeah, I know. I had this memory from when I was very little. When I was a kid, they had Saturday live action as well as cartoons first they had the cartoons and then they had live action, and they were specifically made for kids. And one of the shows they used to have was a show called Isis. And I love that show. It was pre-Wonder Woman. It was a superhero who was really highly intelligent and into archaeology and history and all kinds of stuff I was interested in. And so I really loved it. But nobody else remembered it. Even my brother, who watched it with me when we were both little, didn't remember it.
Hmm.
So years and years and years and years and years and years later, I was at a collectible show, and they had a VCR of Isis. And
mm-hmm.
It's like, I put it on. It's such a kid show.
Yeah.
So corny. It was.
Yeah, I mean, I get that feeling whenever I watch some of the old Speed Racer cartoons, which I loved as a kid, and they seemed very sophisticated to me. And I watch them now, and it's like, yeah, these are A, very bad, and B, definitely meant for little kids.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, she was really, the only thing I thought while I was watching the tape was, she was really a good actress. No wonder I got into it. Because the lead that played Isis, she was
mm-hmm.
very good. It was the other actors that kind of weren't. There were a few actors who became famous later who were okay in it. But, I mean, I think because she was so convincing as the archaeologist teacher and that side of it, that I believed her, even though, because other things I knew was silly. Like, I knew at a very young age that Gilligan's Island was just stupid, but I loved it.
I think I was too naive, and I would watch Gilligan's Island and just get frustrated that they kept screwing up their chances to get off the island.
Yeah, I can understand it. I'm like, the professor is so smart. Why is he getting into trouble all the time? You know?
Right.
He was maybe very confused. Like I said, I saw this in film school. They showed that. They showed some early George Lucas movies and stuff like that. The early 70s seemed to have been a very great time for experimental movies for people who later became super-duper famous.
Yep.
Did any of the other movies of that period influence you at all?
Not really. I mean, it was a great time for filmmaking, and you look back on them now, and you see what a fruitful time it was, and how directors and writers were actually being given the creative control to do what they wanted and to really do interesting stuff. I think I was really too young to appreciate it. I remember from the early 70s were, besides Silent Running, well, there was 2001 that actually came out in the 60s. From the 70s, I think that the movies I remember are like The Sting and I don't know, there weren't that many others. And then the King Kong remake, but already that's like 76. So we were closing in on, we'd already had Jaws, we were closing in on Star Wars. So I can't say that they really did have a big influence on me. Other than sort of the general times, and And watching them later and reading and hearing the filmmakers talking about the movies they were making then, that might have influenced me more once I really sort of opened up to the world of movie making after Star Wars came out.
Because when I was really young, was when this period was, that I was like 9 and 71, and, you know, I was a kid. So I didn't really even know any of this was going on. I was watching television, McMahon and Bionic Woman and
Yeah, me too.
Star Trek.
Yeah. Right. And UFO, that British TV series. I really liked that back then.
And the, what was the name of it, with Roger Moore and Tony Curtis, The Protectors, or Protectors, I think.
I don't know. That one I didn't watch.
It was, I like stuff like that. Action shows like that. But movies, like you said, The Sting, Butch Cassidy, I guess that Raindrops going to win the Oscar. I knew it.
I don't know if I even saw Butch Cassidy in the theaters. I think I might have seen that later on TV.
Oh, yeah, my parents took us to see it. It was during the time, young people will not know this, back in the day when I was a little girl, they had this thing called a drive-in.
Yep.
Parents used to do is they put their babies or young children in pajamas and take this thing that's called a station wagon that you guys do. And they put you in the back and you're in like a nice sleeping bag with your jammies and warm stuff and lots of snacks and stuff. And so you could fall asleep while you're watching movies.
I didn't get to go to a lot of drive-ins because we lived in the city and there weren't any. But every once in a while, when we were up at our country cabin, we would go to a drive-in, and that was always exciting and fun. But of course, the sound. This was, back then. I think it was before they even were piping the movie sound into your car's stereo, and you just had this really crappy speaker that you hung on the window, and the sound was awful. So.
I saw Butch Cassidy. I saw a couple of the Disney movies that way.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were very careful, and I was like thinking about that. Butch Cassidy must have been toward the end of us going to the drive-in because it was later, and we weren't in pajamas anymore. We were just in our clothes and eating a lot of popcorn and stuff like that. But back then it was fun. I was brought up in California, and there was drive-in food places like A&W where you get root beer and burgers and stuff like that. There were drive-in movies. There were all kinds of drive-in stuff. Now it's all gone.
Yep, all gone.
Kind of sad.
Yeah.
You were saying that Star Trek, which is one of my favorites, was very influential. How was it influential?
Well, I mean, I was very young when I was watching. It was the only show my mother would let me stay up late to watch. And I just loved it. It was the most exciting thing. It opened my horizons. At the same time that Star Trek was on, the Apollo missions were happening. And so I was watching real-life space travel, and it looked awfully primitive. It didn't look like fun at all. But Star Trek was great. They were exploring all these exciting places, and Mr. Spock was just the greatest character I'd ever imagined. I wanted to be Mr. Spock. When people would ask me what I wanted to do when I grow up, I wanted to say that I wanted to be on the crew of the Enterprise. But, I was just old enough to know that it wasn't real, and that kind of bummed me out. But then somebody gave me a book called The Making of Star Trek. It was a very dry book. It was meant for grown-ups, but it had a picture section. And I remember, looking through the pictures first before I ever tried to read that book. And one of the very first photos in the section was a bunch of studio technicians in their 1960s, you know, street clothes, working on the bridge of the Enterprise, working on the set, and something in my little kid brain sort of clicked, and I realized, ah, there is a way I can work on the Enterprise. And I think that's kind of where it started.
That's interesting. Yeah, Gene Roddenberry made it really clear how television worked, how was developed. It was actually almost a textbook for people who love movies and television.
Yeah, yeah.
I read that. Yeah, it was a good book.
Yeah.
So, how did you start in the industry? Did you go to college and go to USC?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, how did you start?
We had a TV production class in high school, and I took that, and we did. After taking the TV production class, me and a couple of my friends did an independent study for credit. We spent a whole semester making an hour-long Star Trek spoof called Star Wreck, the videotape. And so that was a great experience because we built it, you know, from the ground up. We wrote the script. We built sets in our classrooms, you know, when they weren't being used. We did special effects with a plastic model of the Enterprise. It was great, and it was a good story too. It was kind of fun. And then, like at the end of the semester, we showed it at the school fair, and we had lines down the corridors and around the corner for people coming to see our little film. So that was part of it. And at the same time, I was also working on the school plays and the school musicals. So by junior year of high school, I had a fairly good idea what I wanted to do. And I went to film school at NYU, and then came to Hollywood to take over the town.
And did you?
No, well, 20 years later, maybe we'll see. There was endless struggle and failure for me. And I think more because I was not a very good salesperson, rather than any lack of skill or talent. I mean, my student film I thought was pretty good, and I got some, I would get just enough attention and just enough success to never give up, but not enough to really make it.
Mm.
So I had a bunch of scripts that were optioned by producers and that production companies would say, hey, this is really good, but, you know, it's not quite what we're looking for, or it's this. I never gave up, and in the back of my head I always thought, well, if someone doesn't hire me to make a movie or buy one of my scripts, then I'll just raise money and make an independent film. Because at some point when I was at NYU, the Coen brothers came in to talk to one of our classes, and we heard about how they raised $100,000 from doctors and dentists to make Blood Simple. And that idea always stuck with me. And so I figured eventually I would do that if things didn't go the way I had hoped. Accepting that things haven't gone the way you hope is a difficult decision in its own right. Just coming to terms with the fact that you've reached the point where you have to make a choice like that. So I probably waited years longer than I should have. But eventually I raised about $165,000, and we made a film called Mutant Vampire Zombies from the Hood. And and that was now a calling card that I could show people and prove that I could do what I'd been telling them I could do for the last, 15 years. And so that got me some work. It got me a writing gig and then a writing and directing gig at a company called The Asylum, which led to another one. And then that led to, through a roundabout series of events, eventually led to Sharknado. And that has opened up the doors to a lot of other possibilities now.
How did you get such big stars for that movie series?
Were there big stars?
Well, there were people that were well known.
Well, yeah. It's funny because when we were first casting Sharknado, originally I was going to direct Sharknado. But I had another project that ended up being scheduled to go at the same time. It was a little science fiction film called AE. And since I'd already done one tongue-in-cheek horror disaster film kind of thing with mutant vampire zombies, I decided to, since I could only direct one of these two projects, I decided to let Sharknado go and direct AE instead. So I was off in the jungles of Costa Rica for a couple of months shooting my film while Anthony Ferrante was directing Sharknado in Los Angeles. And what's funny was that while they were in the casting process, they called me up in Costa Rica, or they emailed me, I guess, and they asked me to create a new copy of the Sharknado script, but with the title Dark Skies instead of Sharknado. Because apparently nobody wanted to be in a movie called Sharknado. Everybody that they offered it to turned it down. And in fact, Anthony was like the third or fourth director that they had to go to. Once I decided not to direct it, they went to two or three other people who turned it down before Anthony finally agreed to do it. And so finally the casting call went out for Dark Skies, and that's how they got Ian Ziering and Tara Reid and I guess John Hurd. And then it was like on the second, I hear this from Anthony, it was like on the second day of shooting that the rumor gets out on set that it's actually going to be called Sharknado, and the cast staged a mini rebellion, and they pulled Anthony aside and they said, "Look, you can't call it Sharknado. We'll never work again." And he can, I don't know if he convinced them, but he told them, "Trust me, that it's a great title. It'll work." And of course, it did. And they were all very happy to be part of it. And so once the first Sharknado blew up on Twitter the way it did, then it became sort of this social phenomena, a pop culture phenomena. And then it was easier to get celebrity cameos. But even then, a lot of people turned it down. In the second one, we wanted William Shatner and John Lithgow to be the pilot and co-pilot of the airliner in the opening sequence. And Shatner's agent had a one-word response to the offer to him: "Sharknay, no." And that was that. So a lot of people have turned it down. There's a famous story about how in the third one, they were going to, again, over my objections, they were going to cast Donald Trump as president. And I said, we can't do that. Even in Sharknado, that's not believable. No one will ever believe Donald Trump could be president. He initially turned it down, and then when they offered it to Mark Cuban, suddenly Donald Trump was incensed that they'd offered his part to another billionaire that he had a feud with, and he said, "Wait, that was supposed to be my role." But by then it was too late, and Mark Cuban did a much better job than Trump would have anyhow. And so I get to tell people that my billionaire president is better than your billionaire president.
Oh, that's funny. I wonder if Bill Shatner actually saw the script, because he actually has a really good sense of humor. And, I mean,
yeah,
he made fun of himself in Airplane 2. Is it Airplane 2?
Right.
Yeah, I think it was Airplane 2.
Yeah, I don't know. I get the feeling that he probably didn't, that his agent just passed on it for him. But who knows?
I mean, he went for the door opening. I mean, he really made fun of Star Trek in that.
Yeah, well, he's always sort of made fun of Star Trek, so.
Yeah, that's true. So what do you have coming up now? Do you have anything new that you want everybody to know about, or are you allowed to talk about anything?
Well, I'm actually on the writing team for a new video game based on a popular television series from the 90s. That's about all I'm allowed to say about that. I'm developing a couple of feature projects and a couple of TV series. The feature project that we might actually do a crowdfunding campaign for, depending on how some meetings in the next 2 weeks go, it's kind of Sharknado-esque. It's called Deadbeard, the Zombie Pirate Rock Opera. So I think that'll be a lot of fun, and we might, if we don't get it set up with one of the companies I'm meeting with later this month, I think we might do a crowdfunding thing on Kickstarter or Indiegogo and try and raise money for that, because it really should appeal to the Sharknado fans. It'll be a lot of fun, and we're hoping to get Bruce Campbell to play Captain Deadbeard, which I think would be hilarious. Yeah, me too.
I love him.
at the same time, right before this interview, I've been working for the past couple of weeks on revisions to a new serious science fiction script that I'm writing, that hopefully I will finally have done in the next few weeks. That's something I've been working on since, I guess, we started in October of last year. And I'm co-writing that with a novelist named Rebecca Cantrell, who wrote the Sanguines series with James Rollins. And then I'm pitching a couple of TV series. So there's a bunch of stuff going on, but it probably won't be out where people can see it for at least a year, probably closer to 2 years, I would bet. So it'll be a little bit before people can go to their theater or turn on their TV and see something new from me. But it's coming. Don't worry about it.
Cool. You work so hard for your career. Do you have any advice for the youngster who's going through the same kind of ups and downs you did?
I mean, the best piece of advice I have is something that you'll hear from everybody who's made it, pretty much, is that just don't give up. You haven't failed until you give up. I was at it for... I was at it really for 20 years before Sharknado blew up. But I never considered myself a failure, because I was still working to make it happen. And a lot of people that I've encountered in the business have said that to me. It's like, you're so tenacious that we're sure you're going to succeed. Now, of course, that could also be delusional. There's no telling, you know, because for every person who says, "Well, I just didn't give up," you know, there are other people who didn't give up and never made it. So you don't know. But that's the biggest thing, is that there's inevitable. You have to understand, going into this business or really any creative endeavor, that there will be a lot of rejection. It's inevitable. People will tell you you don't know what you're doing. People will tell you you're not very good. Mostly people will just ignore you. And you have to be prepared for that. You have to accept it. You have to find a way to deal with it emotionally so it doesn't get you down. But at the same time, you have to listen to what people are saying when they give you feedback, because a lot of times when people are telling you you're no good, you know, the lesson to take from that is not I'm no good, but the lesson to take from that is, well, how are they criticizing me? What are they saying I'm doing wrong? And learn from that. That's the other important thing, is to never stop learning, which is also a cliche, but it happens to be true. And if you never give up and you never stop learning, you know, eventually you might land on that thing that will get you the attention that you need to make a living at it.
Hard, though, sometimes, because you're under pressure from people. You know, whoever will say, you know, you should get a real job, or why are you just focusing on that? How do you countermand that? How do you, you know,
well,
how
mean,
do you keep going?
Well, if it were easy, everybody would do it.
That's true.
So, yes, it's hard. And yeah, you've got to take responsibility for your own life. You have to be able to make a living. You have to keep a roof over your head and food on the table. And if you're not doing that, then, you know, if you're living off somebody else, I suppose they have a right to tell you to do that. But there are ways to do it in your spare time, even if you have to get a day job. So you just do what you got to do. If it's important enough to you, you keep doing it. If it's not important enough to you to keep doing it, then you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. I mean, I go into the film school sometimes and, you know, do guest lectures or Q&As for students. And the very first thing I will do is I will ask for a show of hands, who here wants to be a writer or a director or producer? You know, and most of the kids in the class will raise their hands, and I'll say, okay, now which of you can think of anything else you could do to make a living that would make you happy? And a bunch of the people will raise their hands. And I'll say, okay, you people should go do that. Because trying to succeed in any creative business is a long shot. And of the 30 people in this class, the odds that more than one or two of you will actually make a living doing what you're saying you want to do now is very slim. I mean, it's just mathematics. There's only so many movies and TV shows getting made. Of course, right now there's a lot more than there ever used to be. But still, there are limited opportunities, and it's become a very popular, chic thing to want to do. I mean, when I went to film school in the 80s, it was only just becoming a thing that people actually thought of as a viable career. And when George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola and Spielberg were getting started, you know, if you told your parents or your friends that you wanted to make movies for a living, they would have laughed at you, because that's not something that real people did. Now, you know, since then, it was because of Lucas and Spielberg, really, it became such a popular thing, and film schools started flourishing all around the country. Now it seems like everybody wants to do it, but there aren't that many more opportunities. And so the odds are against you. And so it has to be the one thing that you absolutely feel like you were meant to do in life. And that's both a blessing and a curse. But if it is that way, then keep doing it. And if it's not that way, then for God's sakes, do something else, because this business will rip your heart out and stomp up and down on it.
Absolutely. I was warned when I was a kid. I wanted to be an actress. Mm-hmm. And I was for a while. A friend of my dad, when I was growing up, was an actor. He played in Ironside. He played Sergeant Reese. His name is Johnny Seven.
Okay.
And he loved me. He was like I didn't have a godfather, but he was about as close to a godfather as I had. And he came to every show. He was very supportive. But when I was graduating college, he took me aside. He said, "Honey, you're too sensitive. It will rip your heart out. Don't do it." And I didn't listen to him, of course, but I should have.
Yeah, I mean, actors face more rejection than writers do and filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
because you're out there every day, or you at least you should be if you're serious about it, out there every day auditioning, and the odds are you're not going to get the part.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're good, the odds are you're not going to get the part, because the odds are that the director has a particular image in his or her head of what the character is. And usually, if you don't fit that image, you're not going to get the part, even if you do really well in the audition. Plus, there are going to be a bunch of other people who are doing really well. And one of those people who does really well is going to be closer to what was wanted. So the math is just always against us as
mm-hmm.
As creative people trying to make a living at it. You know, if you're an accountant and you can make a good living doing that and provide yourself the necessities of life, and you want to, you know, paint in your off time, and you're good, well, that's great. You know, or if you're a school teacher and in your off time you want to write a novel, well, that's great. And if the novel succeeds, then maybe you write two or three more, and then you can quit your day job.
Maybe.
But maybe.
Not really.
Right. Well, it depends how successful your books are.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Dan Brown quit his day job. But,
yeah, that's what I was thinking, Da Vinci Code or Harry Potter, yeah.
Right. I mean, I was actually just reading something that James Rollins wrote on his website. Someone asked him when he quit his day job, and it was apparently he was a veterinarian, and it was after he had 5 books on the shelves, and they had all been reasonably successful, I guess, because you have to have 4 successful books in order to have a 5th on the shelf. And he said, once you have 5 books on the shelves that people can buy, and of course there aren't a lot of shelves anymore, but it was after the 5th novel succeeded that he felt like he could quit his day job. It's an uphill road, and it's not for the faint of heart. You know, but if you can do it, it's worth every moment of it.
Oh, yeah. It's your dream.
Yeah. And there are a lot of people, that's why L.A. is such a screwed-up town, because there are so many people who come here and have their dreams broken.
That's why I was raised not around too many people in the business. I was raised in L.A., but my parents kept us away from it. They didn't
mm-hmm.
want us. That's why I think my dad had Johnny talk to me. You know, honey, you don't really want to do this. They supported me. They went to every show. They went on auditions, everything. But at the same time, no, they didn't want me to do it.
Right.
It's a hard thing for a parent.
Yes.
If your child wanted to be in the business, what would you do?
Well, my child is about 10 years old. He's very fluffy and walks around on all fours. and I think he would be great in the business. In fact, he was in Sharknado 3 briefly. if I had a human child, I would say everything I've just said to you, and let them make up their own mind, but with the understanding that once they're done with college, or maybe a year or two after, they're going to have to, you know, fend for themselves. And if you can do that and still pursue your dream, then more power to you.
Yeah, that's true. We've come to the end. I want to thank you very much. Do you have a website or anything where people can watch, you know, see what's going on? And
people can follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/ThunderLevin Official, or on Twitter, I'm just at ThunderLevin.
Do you have a regular website, too?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a website, though?
Not really.
No? Okay.
I mean, my production company has a website, but it hasn't been updated in, like, 10 years, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm too busy doing other things.
So, everybody go to Facebook and Twitter. Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. I really appreciate it.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.